You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters, with this episode made in partnership with Anglo-American Crop Nutrients. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, broadcaster, and general gastronaut. In 2021, it's not enough to produce food in ways that reduce harm to our planet. We need to do it in ways that restore the planet's health. We know that healthy soil needs plenty of living organisms to generate the nutrients that crops need, but many conventional farming practices inadvertently degrade soil health over time. Now, we've discussed sustainable farming before, but regenerative agriculture takes us a step beyond sustainable farming. Not just first, do no harm, but second, do some good while you're at it. Today, we're talking about regenerative agriculture and how to transform to nature positive food production. And joining me are Ross Mitchell, Head of Agronomy and Technical Services at Anglo American Crop Nutrients. Hello there, Ross.
Hello, Stefan.
And Paul Davey, a seventh generation farmer and conservation agriculture contractor. Hello there, Paul.
Afternoon, Stefan. Hi, how are you getting on?
Yeah, really good. Now, Paul, can you first give us a bit of background on your farm and your approach to farming?
We've been farming in North Lincolnshire since the mid-1800s. Then you'd have thought we'd have got used to it a bit by now, but it is an ever-evolving, changing picture, whether that be climate or your business setup. And I think that's a common theme for a lot of farmers in general. We farm from just below sea level near the River Humber to around 450 feet on top of the Lincolnshire Wolds, with a number of different soil types ranging from marine clay through to sort of very free draining grade one calcareous soils, which we used to back in the day, as they say, grow quite a lot of potatoes and onions and brassica and picking peas. And through my grandfather's time on the farm, when there was a lot of available labor, a lot of these horticultural crops made up a large part of the self-sufficiency profile of the United Kingdom. Things have changed significantly through various regimes and also EU membership. We are at quite a large turning point at the moment.
You can say that again. I mean, farming is a traditional industry, very set in its ways. But as you mentioned, change and adaptation is at the heart of what you do. And you know, it has been like that for thousands of years, hasn't it? You've had to adapt.
Yeah, I think even in the time I've been back farming, I would think we've seen changes from intensive horticultural farming through to min tillage cereals to what we've now evolved to with zero till establishment. And I would say at the moment, I'm probably at the conservation agriculture stage, trying to conserve what we've currently got. I think regenerative agriculture is a goal and a significant step further down the line from where I am. But you have to be thinking with that kind of mindset to be able to take the stepping stones towards it.
And why is there a need for regenerative food production?
I think that's a question with a number of different answers. Firstly, economic position of price taking, that there needs to be a shift in how production is brought about, even if it's looking at your inputs, managing your inputs, trying to manage those inputs most economically.
Do you mean literally balancing the books?
Yeah, quite literally balancing the books, I think. It doesn't give you an immediate solution to that. It just helps to focus your mind as to how you're utilizing the inputs within your business. I think people who are involved in conservation agriculture and are progressing into regenerative agriculture aren't necessarily seeing a reduction in their spend. They're spending their input spend differently. We're seeing more trials with macrobacillus type products and trying to utilize nutrition in a way that you would perhaps historically have utilized your fungicide treatments, for example. We aren't necessarily spending less, we're spending differently.
Yeah.
But I do believe that's part of a stepping stone towards more complete regenerative practice where you can regenerate your soils and regenerate your nutrition within a farming cycle.
Can you just give me a very short explanation of what regenerative agriculture means?
Regenerative agriculture is the delivery of common agricultural practice, but through techniques including building fertility, nutrition within the soil through either natural processes with cover crops. I'm an advocate of livestock in both in those arable production cycles. Most regenerative farmers have some livestock. That allows for the fertility to be built for the next crop, which allows the vast majority of its nutrition to be naturally in place as that crop develops without the need for artificial inputs.
Okay. So, Ross, what role can the fertilizer industry play in changing production methods so that they regenerate nature rather than degrade it?
I listen to a lot of what Paul says, and it makes a lot of sense. It's a reflection of how the farming industry has developed, really. I think what we need to really think about now is how that industry will develop next. And I think regenerative agriculture is a very salient topic to discuss. A lot of focus until now has been placed on using the building blocks, the quick ways, I guess, of getting a good economic return for your farming crops. And you start with nitrogen and then you add the other primary nutrients, particularly phosphorus and potassium. I think that the fertilizer industry will be an enabler for the farming industry to be able to balance the nutrient inputs along much better to the crop needs. And that can be by supplying additional nutrients in a more balanced way, but also in a more friendly way. Basically, to make it something that is more representative of what will give the plant what it needs and when it needs it. And this is a good way of encouraging not only the health of the plant, but also in the long term, you can see benefits with the health of the soil too.
Now, you run a team overseeing the agronomic development of Poly 4, which is Anglo-American's polyhalite-based fertiliser. Can you tell us a little bit about Poly 4, and especially in terms of regeneration?
Poly 4 is derived from a mineral called polyhalite, which is a naturally occurring mineral buried deep under the North Yorkshire moors. We add nothing to it and we take nothing away, so it's a very simple product to produce. One of the nice things about Poly 4 is that it supplies a range of nutrients, potassium, sulfur, magnesium and calcium. And it does so with a very low chloride content, which can be important for a number of crops. Also, because the mineral is naturally occurring, it has its own release pattern of nutrients, i.e. the fertilizer doesn't dissolve instantly like a lot of products will. And therefore, it has a much more sustained release of those nutrients, which means that the crop doesn't get a big shock of those nutrients in one go, but it gets access to those nutrients over a sustained time period. And that's how crops are evolved to grow, basically. So we find that it's a good way of synchronizing crop demand with the soil and fertilizer's ability to supply those nutrients. But because it also dissolves relatively over a longer time period, you also don't get a salt shock as you can do with some fertilizers.
So, Paul, do you use practices on your farm that restore soil biology? And what are those practices?
I like to think so, but probably the main practice is time. We've come from a position of heavily cultivating soils over the last 30 years, certainly in the time since I've been back in the family business. And in that timescale, we've observed earthworm populations crashing with a view to then trying to rebuild them. Those small steps are part of what's changed in our farming over the last, should we say, 15 years, where we've moved away from very intensive production to perhaps what you'd call slightly more extensive systems. Shallow cultivations, then moving into zero disturbance crop establishment. We grow grasses in the rotation, legumes in the rotation, either feed beans for protein for livestock industry or vining peas, which we grow for birdseye. Legumes usually following the grasses as we try and obtain a build of organic matter from the grassroots themselves. We feel that there's up to 40 tons to the hectare of organic matter from grass that's been established for 3 years or more. This is then a very natural source of organic matter for the legumes to take advantage of and use the soil bacteria there to create the nodulation for their own nitrogen. We're then looking at then following that with cereals, but from just a natural establishment of crop practice, and really, as Ross was saying, trying to move away from chloride-based fertilizers, but the other, shall we say, improvements to our biology that we're trying to achieve is how we manage our nitrogen applications, which again, for cereal production, are quite high. We get asked the question, with zero till establishment, that we must use rather a lot of glyphosate, but within our rotation and the way that we practice, some of the crops in between, I mean, for instance, if a 2 to 3 year crop of grass is in place, there'll be very, very low inputs on that grass, and that's actually all grass for seed harvesting. That again allows us to run the livestock over the arable acres on the farm, which is quite unusual, but seems to be coming back into fashion. Those are, as I say, the biological approaches. We're undertaking some other trials, purely trying to establish crops in a biological way rather than how we would traditionally establish them. I mean, for instance, we have a trial running at the moment where we have a population of wheat rather than a single variety of wheat. Population is a huge number of varieties which have then crossbred as well. And that's obviously developed to try and reduce the amount of disease within that crop. It also has some different rooting characteristics. We're then trying to grow that crop with very low inputs. We're doing some trials where we have no fungicide at all. And we're just feeding that with nutrition at various points to try and overcome the need for that chemical intervention. And we're interested to see the outcome of that. I'd like to say that, yes, we're at a point where we're 2 to 3 years further down the line, but that will give us some information going forwards to enable us to consider cropping in the absence of certain inputs, which in time will also help us with the fungal profile of the soil.
Mm. So, Ross, how can crop nutrition sources like Poly4 help Paul to protect and regenerate the soil and also, crucially, to prevent nutrient runoff?
Okay, look, Paul again made some interesting points, and I like the way he's integrating not just a fertilizer approach, but also changing his rotation and adding livestock, his cultivation methods. I think taking that kind of whole farm solution is a very good one. I think, though, as he points out, there is a role to play in the nutrition of those crops. I think that there have been long understood links between oversupply, particularly of nitrogen, and getting very vigorous disease infections in an awful lot of crops. I think some of the other components can be related to, for instance, the supply of some nutrients that help with the ability of the crop to stand up and stay healthy for longer, particularly for cereals. And I'm thinking, you know, the interaction between potassium supply and the crops falling over, lodging, as well as when you get in, particularly with horticultural crops, the value of nutrients like calcium in the shelf life and storability of a number of crops and stopping the loss of harvested product like that, which can be very wasteful. But one interesting point that you raise is a fairly new piece of work for us, but something that's quite a high focus is also to think about when you do balance the nutrients supply with the crop need and you're able to grow a bigger crop, what we found is that the system sort of seals itself a little bit better, in so much as the potential losses, particularly by leaching, are improved when you balance the nutrient inputs and you get a nice sustained release of those nutrients into the crop. You know, the crop is not just able to take up more of the nutrients that our fertilizer supplies, but it's also able to do the same with the nitrogen and the phosphorus, which can have big off-site detrimental effects.
So for most of our dinner plates, the journey from farm to fork isn't as simple as it sounds. It's more like farm or boat to processor to distributor to retailer. So, Paul, how important is the provenance of locally grown food in your experience? Things like local dairy and cheeses, whether it comes to our plates via small co-ops or larger food chains. The local nature of it, how important is that?
We're looking at 2 to 3 very different sectors in food as well, and a bit we mustn't lose sight of is the affordability of food, which is another subject in itself. For me, we established farm diversification some number of years ago now, and we focus on locally sourced food from Lincolnshire. It is our very enjoyable, very exciting, and very hardworking wholesale, retail, and online home delivery business, which was established primarily in the early 2000s because of route to market. From a place like Lincolnshire, as I described, as a hinterland to the east of the A1, which, unless you have extremely good suspension, you wouldn't dare visit. It's a challenge for smaller producers in this area to get their product to market. So we looked at how to get the first mile and the last mile managed for those smaller producers so they could concentrate on their productivity. What's been exciting about this is a lot of these smaller producers have maintained their integrity, provenance. They're not in a world where they're in a race to become the largest local cheese conglomerate. These products are prepared, manufactured by traditional methods. They come from farms which I wouldn't say are in terribly intensive operations. Many of them have, especially on the unpasteurized cheeses, the nutrition and the diet for the cattle is very much a balance between biological, chemical, and physical farming. There's a great focus on the biological balance because these products are only as good as the feedstock for the livestock that is producing the milk, particularly in cheeses. It's a small sector, but I'm always amazed by the annual growth. And, you know, we've generally seen growth of 15 to 20% a year of these. And I truly believe it's consumers looking for something fundamentally different. They're looking for something, a product that has a taste, it has texture, it adds to their balanced nutritional diet. For the best description, it's real food. But we also understand that that is a very small sector of feeding society's needs. And when we look at the British farmer, in general, there's been since the post-war push for productivity, there is still very much in the mindset of the nation's farmers that they are here to feed the nation. Mm. I think in the long run, we have a responsibility to feed the nation responsibly, healthily, and actually be part of their overall health. And I believe that's where the direct link from excellent nutrition through producing crops or feedstuffs for our livestock, along with trying to avoid overprocessed foods, that eating naturally gives people a great opportunity to manage their health as well as play a big role in and I think the changing and diverse picture of UK agriculture.
Ross, Paul's mentioned a huge range of farming methods and inputs and feedstocks, as well as regenerative and sustainable agriculture and all different types of methods and tools to use. Do you think that different farming methods affect the quality of produce?
Ultimately, yes. It depends how you wish to measure that quality, I suspect. So you see very clear links between nutritional supply of certain elements and quality of the produce. And I'm thinking of crops like citrus and things. But that will also be true in this country of crops like apples as well, where there's a very clear link between the nutrition and the quality and storability of those produce. And I guess particularly where we have very long supply chains, as we do, you know, we live in an environment at the moment where we are very used to having lots of exotic food available all year round. And that entails very long supply chains. And I think that to deliver that, one of the core requirements that you need in the first place is to get your inputs correctly balanced. And we've seen that over and over again with the work that we've done. And being able to do that just improves the quality of the produce as it reaches the consumer. And that has to be true. I'm all for shortening supply chains, which I think is Paul's suggestion too. And where we can do that and produce food that's nutritious, good quality, and able to hit the right price points for consumers, then that's nothing but good news.
So if we put this in the context of Poly4, can you give us some of the examples of crop quality improvements that can be achieved using Poly4?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some really nice ones, for instance, with tomatoes grown in within mainland Europe. And they have big problems with, again, with calcium deficiency, despite the fact, you know, these are Mediterranean soils with very, very high calcium contents. But you find that at the time that the crop needs it, the soil just can't supply enough calcium. It's as simple as that. You know, the crop grows very, very fast. It puts on a lot of biomass very, very quickly. And it needs that calcium at just the right time. And without getting the right supply from the additional nutrients that a fertilizer like Poly4 can supply, it gets what's known as mineral disorders like blossom end rot. Blossom end rot is like a blackening of the tomatoes, which you won't be surprised to hear is not popular with buyers and processors of tomatoes. So basically it's wasted product, it's wasted yield, and it's something that is a significant problem in large parts of the tomato industry around the world. What we've found by having something like Poly4 in the fertilizer program, it's not the solution on its own, but having it within the fertilizer program, by having that sort of sustained release of nutrients, including calcium, then it's able to just give that boost of supply that the tomato plants can overcome these disorders, these mineral deficiencies and disorders. And we found some very nice results that, you know, the tomato industry get quite excited about, because, you know, this is a problem they've been battling with for a long time.
We're trialing Poly4 this year, which is very exciting for us, particularly in our legumes. So we find that we can see, as Ross was describing, points of peak demand of calcium, particularly sort of a pod set. And as we're looking at trying to increase the number of beans or peas per pod, calcium plays a really big role in this. And we often talk about the availability of calcium, even on some of our chalky soils, that availability of calcium through cationic exchange so the plant can actually absorb it.
Okay, and finally, there's a huge amount of pressure on farmers and food producers' shoulders to act as stewards of our land and our waters. What changes would you like to see to help farmers use nature-positive processes?
I think there needs to be a market available for farmers who are keen to see changes. There are cereal processors who have long held a level called conservation grade. We think that those are the opportunities that are there to lead people in a different direction rather than push people in a different direction. I think there has to be a questionability when some voices saying that it is it needs to be driven into the industry. The industry has to be led, and we have to be able to find properly sustainable markets which allow for profitability through these different conservation techniques. And so incentivization and relationships with different organizations are always better built with trust and trade than through policy. I'm not sure that policy has delivered as much as trust and trade over the years.
Thereby taking the tools out of the hands of the politicians, which sounds like a really good idea. Okay, well, Paul Davey and Ross Mitchell, thank you so much for talking to us. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. And this episode was in partnership with Anglo-American Crop Nutrients. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might like some previous episodes in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farming to sports nutrition. Follow us to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks for listening.